On Black Friday this year, a time when many Americans were focused on family and holiday shopping, the Trump administration released the second volume of the National Climate Assessment, a government report which the federal government is required by law to produce every 4 years. This 1,600-page assessment comes from the U.S. Global Research Program, a consortium of 13 federal agencies, including NASA, DOD, and the EPA, among others. The report lays out in stark terms how climate change not only presents major risks in the future, but how those impacts and costs are already being felt in the United States. Among other things, the report paints a bleak picture of the massive direct and indirect costs associated with warming on our current trajectory. The White House responded by minimizing the significance of the findings of its own government, and President Trump flatly responded, "I don't believe it."
Meanwhile, the rest of the industrial world appears to take the issue far more seriously. Over the weekend, international climate change negotiators announced an accord in Poland charting a path forward for cutting greenhouse gases under the Paris Agreement. Some 200 nations participated. However, the United States was not among them. And the administration has shown little interest in combating climate change. There is increasing activity among states and local governments that do seek to halt climate change or slow it down and shift the cost to companies that emit greenhouse gases.
So what are the kinds of costs and other impacts that climate change could impose on this country? How has the role of the federal government changed under the current administration? Has the government simply eliminated wasteful red tape? And what role have state governments taken on with respect to this issue? This morning, we get the chance to speak with someone who has been at the center of these issues for many years. David Hayes is a nationally recognized environmental and natural resources lawyer who served as deputy secretary of the interior in both the Clinton and Obama administration, and currently leads the State Energy and Environmental Impact Statement Center at NYU. David, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure to be with you.
For most Americans who read these stories in the paper, it resonates at some vague, level, but it's hard to really understand what's going on. Can you talk a little bit about the kinds of costs that we might expect to see from climate change?
Sure. I think many folks who appreciate the fact that climate change is happening also recognize that it's a long-term issue, and there's a tendency to think that the cost associated with climate change will be largely visited on our children and not on us. But what we're finding is that climate change is accelerating, and costs are real and are here today. And they're the costs associated with basically a warming globe. We used to call this global warming. It's a bit of a misnomer because it's more about climate change, but it is in fact associated with an overall warming of the planet as greenhouse gases essentially box in our heat, and there's a feedback loop. So the costs are associated with the impacts of a warming planet, and that means, as you guys know better than anybody, our hydrological cycles are getting screwed up. We're having longer-term droughts that is affecting snowpack. We're having changing weather patterns and longer summers and shorter winters, more rain events than snow events, which affects agriculture. It affects flooding. We're having more extreme storms, which affect coastal infrastructure. The heat is affecting human productivity, folks who have to work outside, et cetera. The global effects, the economic effects, are actually across the board and stunning in their size.
Well, let's talk about that, because the report does go into numbers, and if my memory serves, the initial calculation is about $500 billion a year, which is $500 billion. Obviously, those of us in Park City understand how global impact and could impact our economy here locally, but what about nationwide? What are some of the big areas of that $500 billion?
Well, the energy economy is a good example of one of the big areas. The impact from extreme weather, for example. We certainly have seen that in spades in California with the tragedies there in over the last year and even in recent weeks. Effect on in that case, the high winds, for example, the toppling electricity lines, et cetera, sparking. It's sort of a spiraling downward. You have forests that have dried out incredibly. By this time in California, the rains have come, and generally speaking, fire risk is gone. But no, not this year, not in recent years. So the energy sector has to invest enormous billions of dollars in having resilience to address the impacts of climate change. The ag sector is facing huge impacts. In particular, the changes in the hydrological cycles. There's actually growing regions are moving north, so traditional crops in certain areas are not doing well. And then the human productivity cost is truly enormous. I mean, we're used to air conditioning in our country, but there are a lot of folks who have to work outside. Lower income folks who can't afford air conditioning, et cetera. The other final thing I'll mention, I could go on and on, but there are actually significant health effects associated with climate change. Obviously, the extreme weather, but also there's a phenomenon that exacerbates smog formation because of the increased levels of heat. And smog and particulates in particular are causing enormous impacts on health, a lot of expense associated with the asthma issues, the premature deaths associated with lung problems with the particulates, et cetera. It's not a happy picture.
One of the things you often hear in discussing climate change is cynicism about the degree to which the models that we have accurately predict the future. And one of the things I noticed in the executive summary of the report, which is about all I could get through, was a discussion of how those models have proven relatively accurate. Can you touch a little bit on that subject, and what degree of confidence do you think we should have in these models going forward?
Well, yes. I mean, when you say the word model, I think folks get cynical and somewhat skeptical. What's phenomenal about the climate change arena is that the fact that we're not relying on one model. There are numerous models that have been developed, and over time, of course, models can be tested against real data, and we now have had the operation of models for 10 or 20 years with real data coming in, and per your point. The actual performance of the models in terms of what they predicted 20 years ago is spot on or overly conservative. Many scientists are pointing to the fact that the ice sheet, for example, is melting much more quickly than we anticipated in Greenland. There's less sea ice in the Arctic Ocean than we had anticipated. The temperatures are going up quicker than we had anticipated. So I like to take models out of the equation at this point. The real data that has been developed is showing the impacts. One additional example is it was anticipated that the oceans would be warming significantly because they absorb a lot of CO2. Well, the oceans are warming much more quickly than it.
Most of the CO2, right? About 75% of it.
Correct. Which one would think, okay, good, this is nature showing resilience and being able to absorb carbon dioxide. But what it does is it makes the oceans more acidic. It kills the coral, bleaches the coral. The shellfish in the Pacific Northwest are becoming more fragile and less abundant. So the ocean impacts are tremendous. But the point being that the oceans are warming more quickly. And then, of course, that adds to the more extreme hurricanes and typhoons because of the warmer water gives more energy to these events, exacerbating their negative impact.
So, you know, $500 billion a year is actually, when I read that, it was in the range of believability, right? We talked about the models and how they've proven to be accurate, most of them, certainly not all of them. But let's talk about what the cost would be. Let's say that the United States had joined the Paris Accord. What would the cost have been on the economy to start making those changes? What would the overall cost be? Do you have an idea of that?
I don't. I'm not sure anybody does. And this is one of my concerns about these projected costs. They appreciate your point that they sound believable, and they are, I think, but when you look through the analysis, but many will look at those numbers and say they're just too huge. There's nothing we can do. We need to. What are we talking about here?
Let me put that in perspective, right? I mean, we're $15 to $20 trillion a year economy. So, you know, $500 billion is, you know, 2 to 3% of our overall economy, and that's the benchmark that I use to say I could see where this would be a 2 to 3% drag on our economy,
right.
And it's certainly not going to tank us, right? We're not going to go into a Great Depression because of that. But it could have, you know, the scary thing for me is it could have catastrophic impacts. Certainly, there are people that say that it will. And we could get to the point where it's too late to do something.
Yeah.
We just,
right.
And let's talk about that. How far away are we? Is this something, you know, we've been kicking the can down the road for a long time.
Right.
What happens if the United States kicks the can down the road another 10 years?
Well, the scientist's view is that, we really need to be well on the way toward decarbonizing our energy system globally. And in fact, just to put an outside marker on it that's not very outside, the UN report that the most recent UN report, the IPCC report, that's the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is the group of about 100 international science experts that do peer review, pulling together of science that's available, think that we need to basically decarbonize by 2050, it's game over. That's tomorrow in terms of the energy world. And there has been, the good news is that the technologies, clean energy technologies, have come to the forefront, wind and solar in particular, and are cost competitive now. They're proving out. There are a lot of advances technologically, but the biggest concern out of the Poland Conference of Parties that just finished up over the weekend is that the U.S. Plus the rest of the world is not moving quickly enough to decarbonize. And we have the next 10, I'd say 20 years, are just absolutely critical to get much more on a much more aggressive path to decarbonize and reduce the greenhouse gases that we're emitting.
Now, the other nations of the world, as I understand it, Poland sort of set forth some goals and some timelines for decarbonization. What techniques do you think might work in this country if we were to pursue a decarbonization strategy?
Sure. Yeah. Well, it's not that hard to kind of disassemble. What we need to do is reduce our major sources of greenhouse gases in the U.S. and globally. So what are they in the U.S.? Well, the largest source of greenhouse gases in the U.S. are coal emissions. And about equal to that, in fact, perhaps even more so now over the last year, are greenhouse gas emissions associated with the combustion of gasoline from our cars and trucks. And the third largest source of greenhouse gases are methane emissions from the oil and gas industry. And methane is about 30 times more powerful as a greenhouse gas than CO2, so it has an outsized influence in greenhouse gas emissions. So if you take go ahead.
I was just going to remind our audience who we're speaking to. Our guest today is David Hayes. He's the He was previously the Deputy Secretary of the Department of Interior under Presidents Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, and he's currently the Executive Director at the State Energy and Environmental Impact Center at NYU School of Law. David, sorry for stepping on the second part of your comment. Do you want to finish that, and then I've got a question for you?
Sure. Just to finish, one of the most promising developments in recent years with regard to the greenhouse gases and how to reduce them is in the transportation sector. We now have the possibility, and I think are headed toward electrification of our car fleet. And the fact that we have required petroleum in our cars and the combustion of it was the biggest nut. How could we ever get through that? Well, if we electrify our car fleet and clean up our grid so that it's largely driven by renewable energy, kaboom, there we go with two of the three largest sources of greenhouse gas emissions in the United States.
And it does show how quickly things can change, right? It was, what, 10, 12 years ago that Tesla almost went bankrupt. Elon Musk's vision very much describing what you just shared with us there. So things can change quickly. But as you say, 2050 in the energy world really is tomorrow. I want to get your thoughts. You know, to me, it's amazing how interconnected some of our big social issues in the country are to other important issues like climate change. I was struck when President Trump announced that he was not going to bind the United States to the Paris Accord. What he said was, I'm the president of Pittsburgh, not Paris. And the thought that went through my mind is that was really a statement of income inequality and people doing well in the United States, and then a large group of people that are hurting right now and are having troubles being retrained for different jobs, have been unemployed or underemployed for a number of years. And to what extent do you think that is a reality, that it's this fear that if we fully embrace climate change, that's going to make harder for some workers to get back into the workforce? Do you think that's a real concern, or do you think that's overblown?
Oh, I think it's an appropriate concern. But per your point, this is there's economy-wide forces at work here. The coal industry is on its heels and will continue to decline, not because of environmental regulation associated with climate change. Basically, that there is none right now. The Supreme Court stayed the Obama proposal. It's because it can't compete against low-priced natural gas. But it's a huge hit to coal communities throughout the United States. And I don't think as a country we do enough to support communities that are having to deal with these tremendous changes in our economy, quite beyond climate change. I can't figure out, really, to be honest, any rationale why the president put us out of Paris. Although, technically speaking, we're still in Paris under the agreement that was signed in the last administration. You can't get out until 2020. So we're there sort of physically, but certainly not in terms of spirit and support. But climate change from a overall societal perspective, there's no question that and you talk about income equality, it's actually the folks that are the most vulnerable in society, whether in the US or in Bangladesh or whatever, that are going to suffer the most from the impacts of climate change.
David, before we run out of time, I want to talk a little bit about how the sort of priorities of this administration has caused state and local governments to take on a new role in trying to address environmental issues. And I know that's something that you at the NYU Law School are directly involved with. Can you talk a little bit about how that's working?
Sure. We at NYU, what we are doing in our center is working with state attorneys general from progressive states that have been addressing climate change issues, and we are fighting against the rollbacks of the Trump administration in terms of trying to stop the implementation of the greenhouse gas emission reductions for transportation, for the car rules, the mileage standards, as well as the coal industry's emissions reductions and the oil and gas methane reductions. We also work very closely with governors who are pursuing progressive policies, both to get ready for climate change impacts and to essentially help prioritize where money will be spent to armor the coast or and take other actions to make the cities and rural areas more resilient to climate change. But probably the most important thing that many states are doing now is pushing for more renewable energy and looking to modernize the grid, make it more efficient, enable citizens to have choice of energy and the ability to get renewable energy. We really need to remake our grid and our electricity system, which right now is largely state-based and needs modernizing.
One of the things I've heard from cynics and skeptics is that the electric car doesn't do you any good if the electricity is produced by coal. So the notion of a holistic system of energy that runs from a renewable electricity source through the vehicle is pretty critical.
Absolutely. And there are a lot of positive signs there. Obviously, the state-based requirements that increasingly a higher and higher percentage of the electricity produced by utilities that are regulated by states needs to be clean energy. That's helping immensely. The other economic force I'll put out there is that the largest electricity buyers in the United States increasingly are demanding 100% access to 100% renewable energy. And that includes not only the Googles and the Microsofts and the Facebooks of the world, but also Walmart, General Motors, and others. So you're getting now a competitive force in the electricity sector pushing toward more clean energy. And at the consumer level, where states allow folks to put solar rooftops on their homes, et cetera, folks like to have more access and ability and power, if you will, to make their own energy choices. So
and
these are all positive developments, I'd say.
They are, and that's where it's a win-win-win, right? When it's natural market forces, when clever folks like Elon Musk and others come up with solutions that we all want and help get us to the goal that we need to be at. We've only got time for one last question, David, and I wanted to talk to you about your days as Deputy Secretary of the Department of Interior under President Bill Clinton and Barack Obama. Michael Lewis has a new book out where he talks about the civil servants that serve on various administrations, their career employees. And I wanted to give you a minute to just take us inside the Department of Interior and tell us about some of the people you worked with that have spent their life trying to protect the environment for all of us.
I had the honor of being the Deputy Secretary and Chief Operating Officer for the Interior Department and its 70,000 employees. And of those 70,000 employees, there are only 100 political appointees at the very top. The department is really run by dedicated career folks. God bless them, but they are fabulous. And they're the national park rangers that greet you at Arches National Park when you come in. They're the water managers at the Bureau of Reclamation who help deliver. They're the largest water wholesalers in the world. In terms of Western water, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, et cetera, and the Department of the Interior is a department that affects a third of the landmass of the United States through the public lands, as well as the wildlife responsibilities they have and the water responsibilities. They're stewards of the U.S. And I was very proud to work with them. They're having a rough time right now. They've just lost their secretary, and they've been dealing with a lot of difficulties, I'd say, under this administration. But they carry on, and we should all be thankful to them.
We've been talking with David Hayes, former Deputy Secretary of the Interior and currently the Executive Director of the State Energy and Environmental Impact Statement at the NYU School of Law. David, thank you for taking the time to visit with us this morning.
It was my pleasure. Thanks for having me.